Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Care Options Oncology Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Quill. Today's episode features Dr. Erica P. Hamilton from the Sarah Cannon Research Institute and Dr. Kamal Javeri from the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. They will be discussing how they approach the management of patients with HER2-positive breast cancer in their clinical practice. This episode is part of a larger educational program titled Smarter, Stronger Together, Achieving Quality HER2-Positive Breast Cancer Care by Educating Providers and Patients. For more information on the experts, along with a link to the complete program, including a downloadable slide set and expert commentaries, please visit the show notes for this episode. Now let's get started and hear what the experts have to say.
Hello, everyone. Thank you so much for joining today for this exciting podcast where we will be talking about treatment for HER2-positive breast cancer and covering both the treatment selection and sequencing plans in the early stage and late stage disease. I'm Kamal Javeri, breast medical oncologist from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. Joining me today is Dr. Erica Hamilton. Erica, to you.
Absolutely. Thanks so much. I'm excited to talk a little bit about HER2-positive disease post-ASCO now. I'm Erica Hamilton, medical oncologist. I direct the breast cancer research program at Sarah Cannon Research Institute at Tennessee Oncology in Nashville, Tennessee.
All right. So the way we were going to talk about this today, I think we were going to first tackle what have you learned in early stage disease? What are the new updates that have been presented at recent conferences, including ASCO this past month? And so why don't we start talking about what is the current standard of care for our patients with early stage HER2-positive breast cancer, Dr. Hamilton?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think some of the clinical trial data over the past, in particular, couple years hasn't quite reached neoadjuvant-adjuvant therapy yet. It's mainly been trastuzumab deruxtecan, which is in the metastatic setting, and now, as we all know, for HER2-low. But we really think about neoadjuvant and adjuvant therapy for HER2 disease in terms of patients' risks. So for our highest risk patients, those with tumors larger than 2 centimeters or lymph node positivity, we typically think about TCHP, so our combined trastuzumab as well as pertuzumab with chemotherapy. For intermediate or lower risk, we think about TCH, so leaving the pertuzumab off there. And for our low risk patients, patients with less than 2 centimeter cancers that are node negative or our elderly patients, we think about the APT regimen, which is our regimen of weekly paclitaxel in combination with trastuzumab, and tends to be quite well tolerated for our patients. Kamal, tell me, do you think of this any differently? And what do you do about anthracyclines? I personally really am very hard pressed to find a HER2-positive patient that I'm adding anthracycline to their chemotherapy at this point.
Yeah, I think I do the same. I think for our node-positive patients or larger tumors, I am offering neoadjuvant therapy, and similar to you, have been utilizing, you know, a trastuzumab pertuzumab based combination in the neoadjuvant setting. And that gives us an opportunity not only to understand the biology and the response they have, but we now have therapies to offer at the back end if they have residual disease. So certainly a good impetus for us to offer these neoadjuvant regimens to these patients. And then for our lower risk patients in the adjuvant setting, so those tumors that are less than 2 centimeters that are node negative, I think they are undergoing surgery upfront. And so the APT regimen, as you pointed out, is such a friendly option, whether it's an elderly patient, whether it's this patient that of low risk, regardless of age, or for somebody who had some other toxicities that we had to keep in mind, because the disease-free survival rates are so, so attractive, even at the 7-year time point that we've seen from that regimen. And yeah, I completely agree with you with regards to anthracyclines. I think back in the day, we all always thought about a very high-risk patient to always receive an anthracycline-based regimen. But now we have more and more evidence, turns out, that we don't necessarily need to offer anthracycline for every high-risk patient, and we could get away with perhaps other therapies, including a taxane and a carboplatin or a taxane and cyclophosphamide with dual anti-HER2 therapy in the upfront setting. So I am along the same lines as you.
Fantastic. You know, I think that is important foreshadowing. You know, I think part of the reason that we've dropped the anthracycline out is that historically the HER2-positive patients really had the poor prognosis. And that's changed with dual antibody targeting. And now with the Catherine data that we saw several years ago, and those really are very highest risk patients. You know, they got good HER2 targeted therapy in the neoadjuvant setting and had residual disease. And by adding T-DM1 there, we are improved disease-free survival up to 88%. So it was an absolute magnitude of benefit of 11%, really increasing disease-free survival from 77 up to 88%. And this is a really striking statistic for me. I mean, we're essentially taking our highest risk patients that didn't have pathologic complete response and still able to cure almost 90% of them. So I think that's really encouraging. There's certainly some new trials in this space. Some of our newer drugs trying to party in the adjuvant setting as well. Now we have a trial looking at T-DM1 head-to-head with trastuzumab deruxtecan. We also have a trial looking at traditional T-DM1 per Catherine versus T-DM1 in combination with tucatinib, our HER2 specific tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And then finally, we have a trial that's T-DM1 versus T-DM1 plus atezolizumab. So adding immunotherapy and testing the benefit there. So I'm really excited to see what we see in these three adjuvant trials. What about you, Kamal?
Yeah, no, I think it is certainly an exciting time. And I think you pointed out all the right studies. I think the theme here that we're noticing or seeing is that how do we figure out a way of personalizing or optimizing a therapy for a given patient? And when do we say less is really more, or when do we say more is needed? And I think that's the theme that we're now seeing. Where can we get away with less chemotherapy? That's where this should every patient get an anthracycline? I have to admit, it's not that I have completely given up on anthracyclines. I do think that the practice pattern, at least for me and for many others, have certainly changed where we don't necessarily blindly just offer anthracyclines to every patient. I still do offer for a highest risk patient anthracyclines. I sometimes do also struggle with the side effect profile for the other chemotherapy regimens as well. And so with that in mind, I have still used for high risk patients anthracyclines, but at least it's not for every single patient. But yeah, I think the theme about trying to de-escalate the anthracycline regimen where we can, what do we do with patients who actually can get away with getting a better chemotherapy or a less intense chemotherapy regimen with dual anti-HER2 therapy? That's a great question that is being addressed in the COMPASS HER2 study as well, where patients are getting taxane with HP. So this is weekly paclitaxel with HP. And if they do not have clinical residual disease, actually, if the imaging shows residual disease, they can get a biopsy to confirm, and they have the option to then get standard of care anthracyclines. But if not, they can just get to surgery. And if they have a pathological complete response, it's a physician discretion as to what to offer at the back end. I think those trials are so attractive. On the other hand, the trial that you mentioned about T-DM1 versus T-DM1 plus tucatinib, I think that's a fantastic study as well. And we'll talk about tucatinib and T-DXd when we cover the metastatic disease as well, to put these trials more into context in the early stage. Maybe we should also talk about what other agents do we use in the adjuvant or, you know, in the patients who have residual disease and we can use at the back end. Maybe certain TKIs. You want to comment about the Extenet trial or the role of neratinib in such a setting?
Yeah, absolutely. So if we're kind of talking about de-escalation, this is the other side of that coin. This is a clear escalation for patients that you worry have a poor prognosis and significant disease. Extenet was a trial of adjuvant neratinib after completion of a year of HER2 therapy. You know, clearly this trial was done before we had Catherine, before we had adjuvant T-DM1. And so it really leaves us in a little bit of a lurch how to interpret the results in light of now T-DM1 and the improvements from Catherine. We saw really kind of a 2 to 3% benefit in all comers. But when we looked, it was really the ER positive tumors, the patients that had ER positive disease that was driving this benefit. And so among those with ER positive disease, the benefit was 4.4%. So in my practice, at least, I really don't think about neratinib for our patients that are ER negative, but I do consider it for ER positive and those that are at particularly high risk. What about you, Kamal?
Yeah, no, I think I completely agree with you. I think it's such a data-free zone with the Extenet data because now we obviously use pertuzumab for our high-risk patients. We also have a T-DM1 as per the Catherine trial that you just told us about. And so it's very hard to put the Extenet trial results into context for every single patient. But for your highest-risk patient, as you said, especially the ER positive patients, I guess, because of the crosstalk between ER and HER2 that we've consistently seen, that perhaps there is a better role for these TKIs in that patient population. We also heard updated results from the ASCENT study that were presented at San Antonio, where we showed that even in the HR positive group that had received or had completed trastuzumab less than 1 year ago and had initiated neratinib, after they had not had a PCR, so those with residual disease, so this is your highest risk patient population, that absolute benefit was 9%. So I think short of having such a patient with ER positive disease, which has bad biology, you've seen residual disease despite optimal therapy, I'm not necessarily utilizing neratinib for all my patients.
So, you know, I think one of the concerns with neratinib clearly is toxicity, you know, that a lot of people can struggle with diarrhea. And, you know, we're not talking about a short time, you know, we're not talking about just 4 chemo treatments, et cetera. When we're talking about these TKIs, we're typically talking about a year or even longer. And so it's really important that we make sure that these therapies are tolerable for our patients. I think one of the advances we've made is maybe a little bit more understanding and supportive care around the agents we do use. Certainly, you know, pertuzumab can also have diarrhea. I think, you know, we've been pretty good at now counseling our patients around using loperamide, you know, having that on hand, you know, using it if necessary. And it tends to be a little bit worse when it's given concurrently with the taxane. And then after the taxane drops out, and it's just the trastuzumab, pertuzumab continuing. Oftentimes, it's, you know, quite manageable for my patients at that point. We certainly, you know, see nausea with our chemotherapy. Certainly, antiemetics, 5-HT3s, things like prochlorperazine, even you know, new drugs like NK1s, et cetera, have also been really helpful in managing nausea. And then scalp cooling, I think, is a relatively new arena. We probably can get into this when we talk about metastatic disease, but, you know, it doesn't appear to be quite as helpful with antibody drug conjugates. But for chemotherapy drugs with a shorter half-life, like taxanes, you know, a lot of patients can get away without losing a lot of their hair and having significant alopecia with scalp cooling. And then finally, we now have randomized data with cryotherapy. So essentially putting the hands and the feet in cold ice packs or, you know, gel ice packs like you would see in a kid's lunch, et cetera, can actually reduce neuropathy, which is a really important side effect and unfortunately one that can really last for some time for our patients. Is there anything else that you do, Kamal, in terms of supportive care for this regimen?
For neuropathy, we certainly use a gabapentin and pregabalin. The only other thing that I'd probably add is that, you know, we've also started seeing the benefits of acupuncture, of course, in a trial setting. So we have Dr. Ting Bao here, who's, you know, our breast medical oncologist that focuses a whole lot on integrative medicine and has done a lot of work actually with acupuncture, maybe with aromatase inhibitors, but also with taxanes. And I think something that we're really seeing beneficial is the use of acupuncture for these patients who start developing this neuropathy, some more than others. And given the Catherine trial, where we are now utilizing T-DM1 at the back end after patients have already had a taxane up front, I think it has become more and more important that not only do we require medications for neuropathy, but we also have supportive strategies such as acupuncture and cryotherapy that you mentioned for our patients when we give them these therapies. So I completely agree with you.
That's a great point. And I'm glad that you brought up T-DM1. You know, one of the trials that I'm really excited about is the ATTEMPT 2.0. I love the title too, which is essentially, you know, a shorter duration, 6 months instead of 12 from T-DM1. What we learned was that, you know, having that antibody drug conjugate for a full year, really fatigue seemed to be a driving symptom that was bothering patients. We certainly can see other side effects from T-DM1. You know, certainly you mentioned neuropathy in light of most of these patients just have had taxane. And then also thrombocytopenia is a pretty prominent side effect that we have to manage with patients as well. And then, of course, with neratinib, diarrhea and fatigue, I think, tend to be the most prominent side effects. We certainly use antidiarrheals with neratinib, but also the dose escalation where you kind of start with half the number of pills and then every week kind of add more pills on really allows people to get used to it. I think, you know, their body gets used to it and also they get used to how to manage it. And this has helped quite a bit in terms of diarrhea as well.
I completely agree. And I think that strategy is so helpful in addition to the loperamide that we certainly really, really stress in the first month, because I think what we've seen is the diarrhea is bad in the first month and then somehow becomes a little more manageable at the back end after. But I think all these supportive strategies, including the dose escalation for the control trial and also the loperamide, and making sure we're communicating this very well and discussing with our patients appropriately, has been very, very helpful. Let's also take a moment and maybe just talk about, you know, how these therapies such as neratinib or tucatinib might potentially have a role for prevention of brain metastases. And how does that come into play? And what do we know about that for patients who get these in the early stage setting? You want to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think we don't know the answer yet, but that's certainly a place that I'm really excited about. We certainly don't have any prevention data, but we know that our current drugs, don't cross the blood-brain barrier well. And so conceivably, if we had a drug that really got into the brain well, that maybe we could be, you know, curing as well as we do systemically and preventing these brain mets before they start. So I think that's a place where, you know, adding the tucatinib to the T-DM1 and the adjuvant setting is very interesting, as well as just bringing tucatinib up earlier lines in metastatic disease, because it does tend to be, you know, not uniformly, but it is more common for patients to have brain mets with later line treatment than it is upfront.
Yeah, I think so. Trials such as the T-DM1 versus T-DM1 plus tucatinib, and you know, the role of neratinib, I guess, in that very high risk patient population would also be helpful. But yeah, I think we're really looking forward to those data when they're available, because I think that would really be a game changer for our patients.
So why don't we switch over to metastatic HER2 positive disease? And I may let you kind of walk us through how you make decisions around first line therapy, whether it's de novo disease or recurrence, and does that matter in your practice?
Yeah, such a fantastic question. I think, you know, we definitely still follow the Cleopatra regimen of a taxane with dual anti-HER2 blockade, so trastuzumab and pertuzumab, given the unprecedented progression-free survival and overall survival that we've seen that has held through despite a long 8-year follow-up result that we've seen. And perhaps we'll see an even longer follow-up of those results. And I think so that has certainly been our practice in the first-line setting, and I continue to do that. If there are patients who have progressed very quickly on their early stage patients, and I have to say, I haven't come across many of those, to be honest, not recently, especially after we've had the Catherine trial data, we've had the extended trial in potential patient that we could have offered to. And so I haven't seen a whole lot of that happening. But for that patient who unfortunately did land up having tricky disease, and despite all these excellent therapies, did land up having early recurrence. And I'm talking about early. I think about that as a treatment-free interval of less than 12 months. So a very short treatment-free interval. Short of such a patient, whether it's de novo or recurrent disease, I am offering the Cleopatra-based regimen. For those patients who I think have a short treatment-free interval, I think we now do have an option of considering trastuzumab deruxtecan, because we would have otherwise offered them T-DM1 as well. So depending on how much disease they have, what kind of presentation they present with, if they have a short treatment-free interval, I'm offering them an antibody drug conjugate in that setting. What about you? What do you do?
Yeah, I practice very similar to what you're describing. So I don't think anything to add there. Do you see first line therapy changing? Do you think there's any agents in the pipe that are going to challenge in first line?
I absolutely think. I think we are very greedy oncologists, all for the right reasons for our patients, right? We want to get more and more so that we can have a larger impact in the outcome. And now that we have such excellent therapies that we will discuss and talk about today, including trastuzumab deruxtecan, the triplet of tucatinib, capecitabine, and trastuzumab, we have other antibody conjugates and other agents cooking. I think now the question is, can we bring these newer active agents even early on? And can we actually replace the THP regimen that we are using for the Cleopatra in the first-line setting? And in that context, I'm really looking forward to trials that are looking at the trastuzumab deruxtecan, either alone or with pertuzumab. So Destiny 09 is looking at T-DXd plus pertuzumab as a combination. We've also seen some earlier results of immunotherapy such as durvalumab and others with T-DXd. And I think one would wonder if we have T-DXd doing so well in the second or in a pretreated setting, what would the impact potentially be in the first line? So I'm looking forward to such changes in the first line as well. And those trials are underway.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you. And I'll add one more to catinib. You know, we typically give the taxane in combination with trastuzumab and pertuzumab for 6 cycles, 8 cycles, maybe to maximum benefit. And then we drop the chemo out and continue just the antibodies, the trastuzumab and pertuzumab. And there's a tucatinib, a kind of maintenance study that's looking at the addition of tucatinib to those two antibodies. And so that's a place, like when we were talking about earlier, that I'm intrigued to see whether we might be able to prevent brain mets. So I definitely think there's going to be some new things coming to first line.
I just thought of one other thing that I thought we could talk about and add is that for our triple positive patients, I think we have exciting trials going for ongoing for them as well in the first line. So we might hear very soon on the Patina trial that is actually evaluating, as you reminded me when you said that, you know, in the first line setting, we give them about 6 cycles or maximal response, and we drop the chemotherapy backbone and continue maintenance HP. And the Patina trial is trying to look at, can you do the maintenance along with endocrine therapy alone for a triple positive patients, or endocrine therapy plus CDK4/6 inhibitor, in this case, palbociclib, with the maintenance regimen. And I think that would be an exciting one to look at. Similarly, for those patients whose tumors harbor PIK3CA mutations, we have trials such as the EPIC-B2 and others underway now that are looking at adding a PI3K inhibitor in the maintenance HP setting after patients have had the induction chemotherapy with THP. And so this is coming from the fact that these patients whose tumor harbor PIK3CA mutations, they have poor prognosis. And perhaps if we can offer them a PI3K inhibitor in the maintenance setting, we might be able to get a better PFS or an hopefully expected PFS from the THP regimen, as we saw in the Cleopatra trial. So I think those two trials would be very exciting.
What about second line? We have T-DXd now with recent trial data. We have T-DM1. We have tucatinib. How do you decide between these?
It's great to have the embarrassment of the riches, right? We now have so much data that we can try and think about offering a patient an appropriate therapy based on the scenario that we're facing and the presentation that that patient has. But I think the biggest thing that has really changed the treatment paradigm right now, or replaced our current paradigm that was T-DM1 in the second line setting, is trastuzumab deruxtecan, based on the results from the phase 3 DESTINY-03 trial, where we saw a very, very impressive improvement in progression-free survival. In fact, the primary endpoint is actually blinded independent central review, which is not reached in the T-DXd arm and was about 7 months in the T-DM1, but the investigator-assessed PFS was 25 months. And 50% of the patients on DESTINY-03 were treated in the second-line setting. So really, that has replaced T-DM1 in the second-line setting. But what we also have results for are for tucatinib, capecitabine, and trastuzumab based on the HER2CLIMB study. And this trial was a very unique trial. Not only was it trying to evaluate patients who've had progression on prior trastuzumab, pertuzumab, and T-DM1, and then looking at the benefit of this triplet versus placebo plus capecitabine and trastuzumab, but it also allowed patients with brain metastases. So not only patients that have stable brain metastases, which is something that we see more commonly in clinical trials, but this trial also allowed patients who have active brain metastases. And what do I mean by that? These are patients who have either had no prior brain mets and were newly diagnosed to have brain mets because the trial did screening brain MRI, and they were found to have lesions that were probably not bigger than 2 centimeters, so do not require immediate local therapy. So these are your asymptomatic patients, smaller tumors, but these tumors were detected on the brain MRI that could have enrolled. And they could also be somebody who has received prior stereotactic radiation or whole brain radiation therapy, but now have some progression in the brain metastases, again, not requiring immediate local attention. So these were the kind of patients that were also permitted on this trial. And what we saw was a statistically significant improvement, both in progression-free and overall survival, favoring tucatinib, capecitabine, and trastuzumab. So how am I thinking about my patients? I think if I have a patient who is coming in and has more of a systemic progression and absolutely offering T-DXd, given that we've seen such robust overall response rates, including 16% with complete response rate and a very impressive progression-free survival. For patients who actually come in and present with active brain metastases, I am thinking about the tucatinib, capecitabine, and trastuzumab, especially if the systemic disease is not the driver of disease progression. It's mostly the active brain metastases. Again, active brain metastases that would have fit the bill for her to climb, somebody that we were not going to necessarily go and treat with whole brain radiation or SRS upfront. But it's also comforting to see that even with our antibody drug conjugates, we are now beginning to see some activity from trials such as the Tuxedo trial and the Deborah trial. Mind you, it's very small numbers, but we're seeing some exciting results, at least in smaller number of patients, that they are active. And that whole idea that these larger molecules do not penetrate the blood-brain barrier doesn't necessarily hold true, especially with brain metastases where this barrier is disrupted. So really looking forward to see how that would practice. But right now, I'm giving my patients T-DXd. If I'm thinking about an antibody drug conjugate and the systemic disease is really the main burden, if I've done SRS, I could still offer T-DXd if there's significant systemic burden. For patients with active brain metastases without too much of systemic burden, or for those who have contraindications to T-DXd, I am thinking about the triplet. What about you? What do you do?
Yeah, I'm very similar to you. You know, I agree. We're kind of in the riches here. It's not been very long ago that we weren't deciding between two agents that we were happy to give both of them because of their activity. So I too, you know, if I have somebody that has pretty minimal disease, you know, I also think about tucatinib, maybe just kind of thinking I don't really need trastuzumab, deruxtecan, you know, particularly maybe those patients that are ER positive, and you know, capecitabine tends to be a good drug for them as well with bone only disease, et cetera. Or are patients that have brain metastases, as you said, you know, really good randomized trial data that it improves both progression free survival and overall survival, particularly in those patients that have brain metastases. So I completely agree. You know, I was really reassured to see that the trastuzumab deruxtecan ILD rates, you know, about 10% now. But no grade 4, grade 5, and grade 3 is 0.8%. So we've really managed to have that be all mild cases that are reversible for trastuzumab deruxtecan.
Actually, you presented the updated safety data at the ASCO meeting. Why don't you just walk us through the quick update on all the AEs with T-DXd and what was the update about?
Yeah, absolutely. We know that some of the adverse events are more frequent with trastuzumab deruxtecan. So nausea and vomiting or alopecia, you know, trastuzumab deruxtecan is an antibody drug conjugate that does cause hair loss, which is a little bit different than T-DM1. You know, I think what we've learned is in DESTINY-Breast03, there wasn't mandatory antiemetics up front. And now is even part of the label, we do recommend a multi-drug regimen. So here in the United States, I think most people are giving a 5-HT3, dexamethasone, as well as an NK1. And we know that the nausea happens very early in the first or second cycle, and then it really just stays about the same throughout treatment duration. So I make sure that I've got good antiemetics on board for my patients. And then if they're not struggling with nausea, you certainly can peel some of those back. When we looked at, you know, something called exposure-adjusted incidence rate, so really kind of adjusting for the fact that patients were on trastuzumab deruxtecan for so much longer than they were for T-DM1 because it was working so well, that, you know, all of the serious adverse events and things were actually less frequent with trastuzumab deruxtecan. The only thing that came out to be more frequent was drug discontinuation. And that was really driven by that 8% of patients on trastuzumab deruxtecan that had to discontinue due to ILD pneumonitis. Again, more reassuring that it's mild. We're not seeing grade 4, or grade 5, but still, you know, about 10%, 8% of our patients will have to come off of drug due to pneumonitis. So overall, I was really reassured by that. Fatigue looks very similar between trastuzumab deruxtecan and T-DM1. So certainly kind of adjusting for how long our patients may remain on trastuzumab deruxtecan gave me a lot of confidence in moving it into the earlier settings.
So very reassuring. I think the the point here is that we absolutely need to make sure that we're providing the most optimal supportive management, may it be any drug, whether it's a TKI, whether it's an antibody drug conjugate for our patients. We educate them, we identify it early, we intervene early. And certainly we as a community have become much, much more vigilant about pneumonitis and interstitial lung disease, because we've now started to see that with so many class of agents, including antibody drug conjugates, immunotherapy. We've seen that with everolimus. We've seen that with CDK4/6 inhibitors. So I think we as a community have really started paying close attention to that, and I've become very vigilant, appropriately so, for our patients. Alopecia is something that could come up for our patients. It is very interesting. The alopecia rates for T-DXd that we actually saw reported in the clinical trials were a lot higher than what I have seen in clinic for my patients, actually. And in fact, I would, you know, prepare my patients and, you know, make them really aware that that is certainly a possibility. And many of these patients actually don't land up having alopecia, maybe some hair thinning, but not necessarily grade 2 alopecia at all. Have you been using scalp cooling at all with antibody drug conjugates, or what has your experience been, if any?
I think we're learning that they don't work as well with the antibody drug conjugates because it's really half-life based, right? You know, we're able to cool the scalp while that chemotherapy is going in, you know, causing vasoconstriction, and the chemo just preferentially doesn't go there. But with an antibody drug conjugate, you know, with a long half-life, we're only giving these drugs every 3 weeks. It doesn't seem to help as much as it does with those chemotherapy agents with a short half-life.
Right, right. Exactly. And I think that that is exactly how I think about it as well. I know there are some clinical trials that are now evaluating the role of scalp cooling with antibody drug conjugates, but I think we don't necessarily know if that's going to work or not. But that's an important question for our patients who do develop alopecia, and hopefully we can offer them some options for that.
There's two drugs we haven't talked about in the metastatic setting, margetuximab as well as neratinib. Do you want to touch on those and kind of how you see them fitting into the treatment landscape since things have been moving around a little bit?
Sure, absolutely. So I think, you know, neratinib and capecitabine combination got approved based on the results of the NALA phase 3 trial. And I think we saw similar kind of progression-free survival rates that we've seen with other TKIs and with other medications as well. So in the third line and beyond setting, we're kind of seeing a progression-free survival rate of 7 months, with the exception of T-DXd, where we've really seen a much more robust efficacy outcome. But I think with now tucatinib, capecitabine, and trastuzumab, which is much better tolerated than the challenging diarrhea that we sometimes see with the neratinib, and especially in combination with capecitabine and the T-DXd that we now have approval for, I feel like I'm beginning to start using them even really down the line. And we really don't necessarily have data for, say, antibody drug conjugate, post-antibody drug conjugate yet. We also don't have necessarily all the efficacy outcomes for, say, TKI versus TKI, but certainly these are something that we can continue to use if patients have already received the other optimal therapies and have continued to progress. We can certainly use that.
Well, Kamal, as we wrap up, I was wondering if you wanted to, you know, steal the show and talk about DESTINY-Breast04 from ASCO.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I think that certainly stole the show at ASCO for all, surely, and rightfully so. I love that standing ovation and that energy in the room that I think patients, physicians, everyone collectively felt, and that was so exciting to see. So DESTINY-Breast04, as we were talking about HER2-positive disease, we've been thinking about HER2 disease as a binary way, right? It's either HER2 positive, which we defined as immunohistochemistry 3+, or if it was immunohistochemistry 2+, it had to be FISH amplified, or we were thinking about HER2 negative disease. But I think what we've now started recognizing is that these new antibody drug conjugates, and good example of that is trastuzumab deruxtecan, have something called as a bystander effect. And what does that mean? It is killing of these neighboring cancer cells. So because of this optimized linker and this cleavable linker, the payload is released, and then it actually goes to the neighboring cancer cells and kills those neighboring cancer cells that might not be overexpressing the HER2, but have some HER2. And because of that bystander effect, we're now recognizing this whole HER2 low as a phenotype, if you will, where patients who are IHC 1+ and 2+, which is not amplified, can also derive benefit. And we saw some early signals from earlier phase one studies with trastuzumab deruxtecan that led to this registrational study, and that showed a statistically significant improvement in both progression-free and overall survival in all comers. And you know, in HER2-low, I think we're seeing that about 55 to 60% are hormone receptor positive. And then we also have these HR negative or hormone receptor negative HER2-low patients, and that is about 40% or so. And that was the prevalence that was used to enroll on the DESTINY-04 trial. We had about 480 patients with hormone receptor positive, and then about 60 patients with hormone receptor negative. And so the progression-free survival benefit was seen in all patients, and the primary endpoint was really progression-free survival in the hormone receptor positive patients. We also did see an overall survival benefit, both in the hormone receptor positive and also in the overall patient population. For our hormone receptor negative, exploratory endpoints were looked at, including PFS and OS, and we saw a 10-month improvement in overall survival, even in that patient population. So very, very exciting results, very, very practice-changing results, something that we all got excited to leave ASCO and the very next day apply to a patient in clinic. And very fortunately, this agent is now NCCN supported. It's already in the NCCN guidelines, and we're looking to formal FDA approval as well, hopefully soon, later this year. And I've started using it already. What about you? Have you?
Yeah, absolutely. I have, you know, it's kind of variable until we, get some guidelines and technical approval, but it's always a little easier to get it based on the trial data when the drug is already approved, for sure. You know, I completely agree with you. You know, I sometimes think it's a little bit funny. We spent the past, 10 years fragmenting people, you know, patients that are lymph node positive, patients that have PI3, patients that have ESR1 across disease type. And now we have a drug that we kind of want to use across multiple types, right? What we would typically consider ER positive as well as what we would consider triple negative. But I think this really, you know, to wrap up, goes back to just personalized medicine, where it's not one size fits all or a cookie cutter approach for an individual patient. We're taking their pathological characteristics, immunohistochemistry, profiling, et cetera, you know, all into consideration for kind of a personalized treatment plan that doesn't over-treat them, but gives them the best possible outcome. Kamal, what would you say kind of in wrap up of where we're headed for HER2 disease?
I think, as we discussed, I think we really, really have definitely seen a lot of changes in treatment paradigm for the right. We have seen significant improvements in overall survival and outcomes for our patients, but obviously the buck doesn't stop here and we have lots more to do. We have many questions to address both in the early and late stage diseases. Many trials that we discussed are something that we're really looking forward to, but specifically, I think we're trying to focus in the early stage in optimizing our therapy so that we can offer less to the right patient and escalate where we really have to. We want to think about tackling the question of brain metastases prevention for our early stage patients, because that is something that we struggle with in this subtype, surely. For our late stage patients, I think we're still trying to see if our treatment paradigm is going to change further and if trastuzumab deruxtecan or T-DM1 tucatinib are going to be now utilized in earlier settings that we currently use. We want to understand the right biomarker strategies, especially for our HER2-low patients, because I think the immunohistochemistry might not be the most perfect way of identifying them. We want to understand best sequencing strategies, especially when we start having more and more antibody drug conjugates. And we have many under evaluation, under clinical trials, even for HER2-positive disease beyond T-DXd. And we want to see how can we start thinking about utilizing all of these agents for the better good for our patients. So too much to look forward to, really exciting work ongoing.
Absolutely. It was a pleasure joining you to discuss HER2-positive disease.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much, Dr. Hamilton and Dr. Chiveri. And thanks to you, the listeners, for joining us. As a reminder, to view the full program, Smarter, Stronger, Together, Achieving Quality HER2-Positive Breast Cancer Care by Educating Providers and Patients, and to access additional resources associated with this program from the Clinical Care Options website, please click on the link in the show notes. As always, thanks for listening.